unfortunately enough, for this, and I said, oh, millions of people. And I said, for example, our steel workers in the United States live in unemployment. Their wives, you generally have kids, like, oh, I don't believe that, I don't believe it. So we sat, we stood there in the kitchen of that place, and for, we then began to go from steel workers to missiles. And by the time we got through, it was fairly, it was dangerous, it was strong, but it was the situation where I had to take the position, and not in belligerence, but saying that the United States recognized that we were strong. We also respected the strength of others, but that we were not going to accept the threats which he, of course, was trying to apply to give. Because our power would be used to keep the peace stored. Then the scenario moved on to the Dacha the following day. And there, the debate in the longer sense is this debate continued. All the wives were present, Khrushchev, Mikoyan, Kozlov, and their wives, and on our side, Tommy Thompson, our ambassador, was there. And also Kohler, who was along as our state partner. And for 7 hours, starting right with the first course, we went through the this talk back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And it covered the, I must say, everything. It was extremely interesting that in terms of the 7 hours, just to present lighter moments, however. Khrushchev, as distinguished from most communist leaders that I have met, and I pointed this out in the brief statement that I made after that I covered someone from six crises, was quite different. Put this in the proper context. He was no different in terms of being a totally dedicated, ruthless communist trying to do us in. On the other hand, he was a man of very great vibrancy, personality, color, change in pace, sense of humor, etc. He was earthy. Most communist leaders are dull. He has to go on and on and on with this dialectical materialism debate, etc., etc., etc. I will not get into that. They're, I don't know if I'm getting wrong, they're smart. They're intelligent. They know, they do their homework. But to them, they basically, with no idealism in our sense, no morality in our sense, no religion in our sense, they live solely for the intellectual give and take. And so the conversation after a while, a little intellect is all right, but after a while, it's almost dull. But Khrushchev had a lot of the emotion with him, a lot of the heart. And it really mattered. He was just as cold as ice. The couple of personal points I want to make. A lot was made of his, a lot of Western states who underestimated when he first came to the national scene, because the international scene, because when he went to Vienna, he remembered the Gauguin, B&K, that before he shuttled him off to Siberia, he took over by himself. Right, he was drinking a lot, everybody thought. He was, probably. He could felt it pretty good. But he never drank when it mattered. And that 7-hour lunch, they poured all the stuff in, the vodka, of course, came with the caviar and all the rest, and the brandy and the rest. And I watched him, and I took just what he did. And that was very little. It wasn't liquor with a drink, it was liquor with a sip. And a couple of other little sidelines to show. The first course, after we had the caviar, which I mean, you could have rushed to put it out and give it to their people when they go to the visitors, but they sell it to us. So whatever the case may be, after the first course, they brought out a cold fish that was really delicious. What it was is a frozen lake, frozen Siberian white fish, which they freeze, and then they slice down very, very thin slices, And then they doctor it all up with, if you want, with condiments and so forth and so on. And those in Kershaw get quite a bit of it and so forth. And he used Mikoyan as sort of his end man, the purpose of making plants. He noticed that I like the fish, or his, because you have to like everything. So I dutifully took my second helping of it as he did and called it down. And he said, well, I'm glad you like that. He said, you know, this was Stalin's favorite fish. And and Mickey on China and said, yes, Stalin said it was good to the backbone. That's why he took it. The shop said, you better have a third helping. I said to FDR, I said, what kind of a man is Stalin? And they began to describe very freely Stalin's working habits. He said, well, he was a very hard man to work for because he knew no hours. He said, he'd get up, he said, he worked long hours himself during the daytime, but he would call at 3 or 4 in the morning and have meetings. He said, and Mekion said, you know, we just couldn't get any sleep. He was under stop. And then he turned and Khrushchev a little wink. He says, you know, we sleep better now with Chairman Khrushchev. He could say that both ways. So Khrushchev appreciated that compliment to him. I don't know whether all the people around the table were probably reassured and thought they could sleep over that. I'll show the hands that happened in Camp David. I recounted this too, so a little quick. President Eisenhower gave a luncheon in Aspen for the group. The meeting had gone to President Eisenhower's great structure, not as well as anticipated. We had great hopes that the fact that we were having this first summit meeting, et cetera, that it would mean that they would make arrangements on various things. And they were just like, you've got to expect this and everything. They're just close-legged to me, and all the nice words that we said and the nice toasts that they gave and so forth didn't mean a thing when they got down to the hard deals, which is the way it always is when you deal with such people. And of course, the way we have to deal with them. And so it was a rather uptight meeting, and then they sat down for lunch. And Khrushchev also had just come into the United States in time that they had made some space exploration or something. Significant jumps in the earlier days. I was very proud of that, and brought us one of the space capsules and so forth. This was an unmanned space area. But in trying to make pleasant conversation, President Eisenhower said that, asked Khrushchev about the custom in the Soviet Union about taking vacations. And Khrushchev said, everybody in our government is required to take a vacation of 3 weeks. Everybody in the top government has 3 weeks. So he said, if somebody suggests we're going to start that here, a required vacation. In fact, everybody in the, and that's true in certainly all the communist European countries, 3 weeks vacation is automatic at certain times. They must have heard it from the American corporations. But whatever the case may be, he came. And then Eisenhower, said, he says, where do you go? He says, well, I usually go out to the lakes and sort of down to this. Okay. That's not the then Eisenhower just rather nicely said, well, the trouble is, he was here on vacation since you can't get away from the telephone. And the translation was, and Khrushchev and I just have, because if you have that same problem, Mr. Chairman. And he took it very, very unkindly. He said, oh, yes. He said, well, we don't have as many telephones as you have, but we're going to have more. But that, of course, was the attitude. The way of this meeting is very simple. He says, about the superiority of our system, its productivity, and so forth. We talk about our problems and growth. Their economy has been flat for a long time. Anybody who's visited Eastern Europe, anybody who's visited Soviet Union, you're impressed with some things, but you what is impressive about the leaders of the communist countries is their total, absolute first conviction that they are going to win, and their determination to do everything to win. Call it dedication, call it fanaticism, call it what you will. It is that quality which makes a people who are less civilized, or we could put it more barbaric, less cultured, less educated, less rich, less strong at the moment. It makes them, of course, a challenge to be reckoned with in the world. This was Khrushchev, this man who, with no education, fought his way up through the communist hierarchy. This is true of their scientists, their who are part of the party members. This total, absolute conviction and dynamism is there. And as I look at our own country at the present time, and as I look at our leader class, because if you've read Sheila's study of the Yugoslav communist situation, you'll know that there is a new class of communist countries. If I look at their leader class and our leader class, I would say that the major ingredient we need is the total, absolute conviction that I'm not speaking in any partisan terms, not about this program and the rest, but about our philosophy, that our system is right, that our system should prevail, and that we will win, not in a military sense, but win in a philosophical sense. I think there's been a tendency in the 60s for many who, particularly not among the what we call the working people, not among the farmers, not among the less educated people in this country, but ironically among those who should know better, among those with the better education, those who publish, write for great media, those who are the teachers, those who are the ministers, those who are the politicians, to lose their very great expression, dedication, and confidence about this country. And I can only say, if a man like Khrushchev, who was enormously impressed, General Volpe, more than anything else, not by that farm out in Iowa, that impressed him, but by the freeways he saw in California, all those automobiles on them. But if a fellow like Khrushchev had going for him what we have going for in this country, you wouldn't hear, may I say, any of this constantly running down the United States. The fact of, are we really going to make it? Are we a society that really deserves to lead? Are we the ones that we should be so dedicated to? My point that I make is this, that if they, with the terribly inferior, and this is not said simply as a dedicated anti-communist, it's said only as an observer of various systems of government around the world, terribly inferior, oppressive system, if these men that have such dedication, etc., we, with all that we have, should have as much. And with as much as we've got going for us, it seems to me that that should be rather simple. So I would conclude the meeting by saying that I know that what I just now said to you is like the minister preaching to the choir. I do say, though, that if you go out in the country and you talk, as most of you will be talking, to audiences and businessmen and their wives and educational leaders and all the rest, they'll call it flag waving and they'll say this is inspirational guff and all that sort of thing. But I think that it's just well to speak. speak up very strongly for our system, for what it is, for what it's done for the world, for what it can do for the future, and how much we believe in it. And if you have any doubts about it, at the time you get retired, I'm going to order a little application, have all of you serve. I think I'd like to record this with a picture, if you don't mind, so I think... Well, for those who are, those members of the cabinet who are meeting with the business group, that will be held for those who are home today, because this group will take a little time to change some chairs. Next time we get together in this kind of format, we will probably have a foreign policy area. Thank you.